Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic number of this Friday is 4.1%. The number of the week is $10 billion. That's in dollars. We will explain them both, and we'll have the latest in our series, American Futures. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This is the podcast for the 20th of December. Good as always to have you with us. As official Washington shuts down for the rest of the year, two items of note with which to begin the program today. First of all, the Commerce Department told us this morning the economy, that is gross domestic product, grew at an annual rate of 4.1% July through September. That is a lot, considering where we've been, the best in a couple of years, in fact. And it gets us to the second point. President Obama, on his way out of town, used the GDP and the economy as a jumping-off point for his end-of-year press conference today. Lead with your strength, right? But Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports GDP isn't the whole economic picture, you know.
Politicians, including President Obama, are treating today's GDP numbers like some kind of happy ending in a movie like Miracle on 34th Street. But the reality is more like something outside Hollywood's Christmas canon, Die Hard.
Now I have a machine gun. Ho, ho, ho.
That's Alan Rickman doing a ridiculous accent as leader of a terrorist group that invades a skyscraper while drunken execs celebrate the holidays. They were oblivious to the armed villains outside. American Enterprise Institute labor economist Michael Strain says folks doing a victory lap about today's numbers are also ignoring some scary stuff.
The economy, as it's experienced by people, has not improved nearly as much as some of these GDP statistics suggest.
Cornell labor economist Linda Barrington says there are real villains lurking.
We still have a significant portion that is long-term unemployed. So the biggest challenge we're going to be facing is how do we bring those who really were pushed out of the market for a long time back in as we recover.
Berkeley economist Enrico Moretti points out another evildoer menacing the party.
There's a large number of people who have been discouraged and are not even actively searching for jobs.
The unemployment rate is dropping, but in part because people are giving up. They aren't factored in. With job market problems like these terrorizing the economy, it'll take more than one sunny GDP report to save the day. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This being a Friday, there is lots to talk about. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government are in our Washington Bureau together, I might add, for a weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Sudeep, let me start with you. You know, Mark obviously pointed out some flaws in GDP as the economic number, but by and large, this is a good print, right? I mean, you got to be happy with this.
You have to be happy with this considering what we've gone through all these years. We finally got the growth that we've been waiting for several years. So yay for us that's finally come through. It's 4.5 years into the recovery that we're finally getting this. But you also have to look back and realize we did get this kind of growth at different points in the recovery. In 2010 and 2011, we started to get kind of excited that we were going to come out of the chaos of the recession. And obviously it didn't take off like a rocket after that.
You are not, and I'll ask Neela and for her impression of this. He's not really saying we're going to have another spring where we take another step backwards, is he, do you think, Neela?
I think that is what he's hinting at, that this GDP number may not be sustainable. It's built on a build-up on consumer spending and services and recreation and healthcare. And while recreation makes sense over the summer months, I'm not sure where the healthcare numbers are coming from. Right. And I'm not sure if the inventory numbers that firms are using to stockpile goods is a good sign or a bad sign. I'm still kind of mixed about that. It's a good sign if they're stocking up for future demand. It's a bad sign if it's because they weren't able to sell the stuff they had.
Yeah. All right, Sudeep, let's turn to the other number of the week this week, $10 billion, which is, of course, the amount of the taper, Federal Reserve backing off its big stimulus program. Chairman Bernanke announced it in his final press conference. First of all, were you surprised that it happened at this meeting?
I certainly wasn't surprised that they did it at this meeting. We've been talking for 8 months about the fact that the Fed really wanted to pull back on its magic money printing machine. It wanted to look for, give that a rest and see if the economy could stand on its own legs. And the fact that the stock market didn't collapse at the start of this, and the fact that, more importantly, bond yields didn't surge out of control when they started to do this, means that maybe we might actually get a controlled exit. But this is very early in the process of the Fed doing this. We have to judge the Fed's ability to pull out of this a year from now or several years from now, because it's a very long process, and we shouldn't feel completely comfortable that they were able to get by with just the stock market going up, because the stock market's been doing just fine on its own for a long time.
Neela, I wonder whether the Fed is having its cake and eating it too, right? They started the taper, and in the same meeting, Bernanke said, you know what, though? The federal funds rate, that is interest rates, are going to stay low for as long as you can possibly imagine.
It was like a magic trick. Yeah. Look over here. We're keeping the interest rates really low. We're going to pull away the punch bowl, but we want to distract you with something else. Absolutely. They reassured the markets, and one of the reasons the markets were up so much on the announcement is because there was this commitment to keep interest rates at near zero for a very long time. That's good for markets. The question is it good for Main Street as much as it is for Wall Street?
Just to talk about Washington for a minute in the political sense, you guys, the Congress now has officially, A, gotten out of town, but B, with the budget deal that the Senate passed this week and the House passed last week, they have gotten out of the economy's way, huh, Sudeep?
They have gotten out of the way to some extent. Nobody is going to confuse what Congress did for smart policy. They haven't dealt with a lot of the things that we really wanted Congress to deal with in terms of providing support for the economy. But at least it's a step away from dumb policy. And so given the way things have gone for the last few years, it seems like avoiding disaster is the new definition of success in this town. And so by that measure, maybe we are being successful.
Well, Neela, the last word goes to you, and it revolves around another D word, not disaster, but debt limit. That's coming up in February, and Senate Republicans said this week, you know what, we're not going to go easy into that good night with just a clean debt limit raise for the president.
Yes, lest we get too optimistic and happy. Right. You know, there's always the specter of debt ceiling to keep us grounded in pessimism in Washington. So, yes, the Republicans have already amped up the talk on this, and that they will tie the debt ceiling raise to conditions and proposals, perhaps on Obamacare, perhaps on energy proposals. We're not sure what, but this is an ongoing story. It's going to creep into the new year.
We have seen this movie before. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. They were both in Washington today. See you guys.
Thanks,
have a great weekend.
Have a good weekend. Wall Street took that GDP report this morning all the way to the bank. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The president did make a little bit of news at his press conference today. He said more than 500,000 people have signed up for insurance through healthcare.gov this month. Seeing as how Monday is the deadline to get on board, if you want coverage to kick in by New Year's, that number is probably going to rise. And as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the health desk at WHYY, officials are bracing for a flood of traffic.
Kentucky has prepared itself for the storm.
We increased the number of our call center staff by 50 employees. We also extended our hours to Sunday.
That's Carrie Banahan, head of the Kentucky Health Benefit Exchange. Banahan says enrollment numbers have jumped 40% since Thanksgiving, with 3,000 Kentuckians enrolling daily. With interest so high right now, it's kind of like buying tickets for some super cool rock concert.
There's such demand at times, we just don't have enough lines for individuals to call in. They have to try back.
When it comes to the federal exchange, officials say nearly 2 million people have applied and qualified for coverage. Ron Pollack with the advocacy group Families USA says all that's left for them is picking a plan.
People obviously are taking time and should take time to select the plan. I think we're going to see people taking this last step in the next few days.
What nobody knows is whether healthcare.gov can handle the wave of consumers. Matthew Prince has his doubts.
given the challenges that the system had from the day it was launched, given the short amount of time that it's had before the deadline has come up, it's likely that we will continue to see challenges with the site going forward.
Prince runs the firm Cloudflare, which builds websites and works with federal agencies on their site performance, though not on the federal exchange. President Obama has taken responsibility for improving healthcare.gov. The next 3 days will be its biggest test. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
There was a big win for local governments and environmentalists in Pennsylvania this week. The state Supreme Court tossed out a big part of what's known as Act 13. It's a state law in Pennsylvania that would let gas companies drill anywhere without having to worry about local zoning laws. Think fracking. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Act 13 made some folks' blood boil. It stripped local governments of the ability to say where energy companies could put fracking wells and where they couldn't.
So it completely eliminated local control and consideration of local concerns.
Jordan Yeager is an attorney at Curtin and Hefner. He represented some of the groups that opposed the law. The opinion, he says, that parts of the law are unconstitutional.
It is genuinely a historic victory for the citizens of Pennsylvania and for the public health and the environment.
The court's decision is also a decisive victory for the little guy in the growing battle between states and local governments over drilling policy. Barry Rabe is professor at the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan.
This was one of the first state attempts to craft far-reaching legislation to govern almost all aspects of shale gas drilling or fracking.
There's a fundamental question of land use here. Who's in charge? That's popping up around the country, in Colorado, Texas, New York.
Do states decide? Do local governments decide? Do they work together? Or in the Pennsylvania case, do they collide, meet in court, and then presumably states and localities have to pick up the pieces in Pennsylvania as they go forward on this issue?
Right now, says Rabe, we're in uncharted territory. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Standard & Poor's, the credit ratings people, weighed in on two different parts of Europe's economic reality today. S&P stripped the European Union of its AAA rating while at the same time reaffirming that rating for the UK. One agency certainly isn't the last word on a country's creditworthiness or its financial health, but a lot of young people in southern Europe seem to share S&P's take. They're leaving home, countries like Greece and Spain, where the unemployment rate can be 25% or more, and looking for work in London. And that is where Marketplace's Stephen Beard wraps up his series, Jobless Generation.
There was a time, about 400 years ago, when a boatload of Spaniards bobbing up and down on the Thames would have caused absolute panic in the British capital. Not anymore, of course. This is a floating Spanish-owned pub. Not part of an armada, but part of a friendly Spanish invasion. On board, watching a Spanish soccer match on satellite TV, are some of the tens of thousands of unemployed young Spaniards who've come to London to find work and a good time. Jorge Ruiz runs a Spanish language blog in Britain.
London is always popular. It's always a place to be, a cool place to spend a few months. When I first came, for me, obviously, it was amazing.
He reckons more than 100,000 Spanish people have come to London since the crisis began. Daniela De Rosa runs an Italian consulting firm in the city. She says every month 3,000 of her fellow countrymen and women have also been arriving here.
They are many, too many maybe, and they are not the Italian only coming here. There are the Greece, the Spaniards, there are the Chinese, the Indians, there is the whole world. There are opportunities, many opportunities here, but not for everyone.
Hot, hot, hot! Hot, hot!
25-year-old Javier Duque from Spain knows that only too well. He has a degree in communications and wants a job in marketing. But for the last 1.5 years, he's worked in a menial job in the kitchen of this fast food restaurant.
As the time went by, I started to think, what am I doing here? I don't belong here. I'm a little bit fed up, you know? Actually, I'm really fed up.
Javier knows that the best way to get a better job is to improve his English, but that's not easy when your girlfriend is Lithuanian, your flatmates are Polish, all your colleagues are foreigners, and you don't even meet English people going to and from work.
When you get on a bus, most of the time, you don't hear anyone speaking English. Many different languages, but not English.
You've come to the wrong city if you want to learn English.
Yeah.
Many of the South Europeans, like half of all young British graduates, have wound up doing jobs for which they are overqualified, in some cases comically overqualified. Mariano Cruz from southern Spain has a degree in philosophy. He's now in London, working in the warehouse of a chain of sex shops.
You're picking dildos and condoms and that kind of thing. So.
What does your mum and dad think about this back in Spain?
Well, I didn't tell them the whole truth. I didn't tell them the whole truth.
And from northern Italy, 27-year-old Marta Gambron has been forced to earn her living making salads for restaurants in London. She can't find full-time work as a graphic designer here, even though she has a degree and experience in that field.
I'm not happy, you know.
You're not happy?
No, not totally happy, yeah. I'm not doing what I want to do in my life.
But Marta, who's been in London for a year, wouldn't dream of heading back to unemployment in Italy.
London is a wonderful city. It's amazing. You can feel free. You can be what you want to be.
But you can't be a graphic designer.
Not yet. Yeah, I hope in the future. If you keep trying, you can realize your dreams and you can be what you want to be in your life here.
In London's expat European bars, Spaniards, Italians and many others still enjoy the welcome this incredibly cosmopolitan city provides. But they can't take it for granted. The government here is now talking about caps on the number of Europeans allowed in. London may not always be a source of hope and an escape route for Europe's young unemployed. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, the orange industry for the city of Redlands is actually, from an economic or financial point of view, minute. But from a heart share point of view, it's huge.
American futures, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On a Friday, the Dow Industrials added 42 points today, 1.25%, closed at 16,221. The NASDAQ gained 46 points, about 1.1%, 4104 at the bell. The S&P 500, 8 points, up 0.5%, ended things at a neatly symmetrical 1818. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow tacked on 2.9%, the NASDAQ climbed 2.6%, the S&P 500 added back 2.4%. Oracle announced it's buying Responsys, which makes software for online marketers. Responsys jumped 40% as a result. Oracle dipped 0.6%. The software developer Red Hat beat earnings estimates and climbed 14%. Finish Line, which makes athletic apparel, turned a small profit for the quarter, and that earned it a 6% bump. CarMax, though, reported a lower profit than expected and took a 9% hit. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.89%. And yes, right about here, folks, you ought to be saying, taper? What taper? You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace, so please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Did you finish all your shopping on Black Friday? We'll find out when the Commerce Department releases personal income and spending for the month of November. And on this day in 1823, the night before Christmas was first published. And of course, happy Festivus, Seinfeld fans. In the words of Kramer, Festivus yes, bagels no. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. We've got a series going with Jim Fallows, the national correspondent for The Atlantic, and his wife, Deb. Them going around the country in their small plane with us joining en route from time to time, trying to get a sense of what America and the American economy look like right now. We're calling it American Futures.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Sea Balls approach Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo. We've got Tango for landing.
Today, though, no plane required. We're only going about an hour's drive east of Los Angeles, Redlands, California, Jim Fallows' hometown.
Mr. Fallows, I will tell you, could not have picked a better spot.
My parents had great foresight in choosing this as the place to raise their family, but it's a great place.
Redlands was, at one point, the naval orange-growing capital of the world. Today, just a small fraction of the old groves are still here, plowed under for homes and development, of course. But that is not the end of the orange in Redlands.
The story people tell themselves here is how lucky they are to have all the fruits of the generations of people who've planted groves, who've built parks. And so it's up to them both to be aware of that and to make the investment for the next generation. So they feel the kind of local patriotism we found in a lot of otherwise very different cities.
Here's another way to think about that. Redlands is using its past, its orange groves, to build its future. A future that can be found, funnily enough, in beer.
Oh, smell that.
Yeah.
So there's some yeast. Also, what is it? Is there orange in the air? Do I smell orangeness?
Maybe it comes from these hundreds of thousands of oranges in front of us.
Hangar 24, one of the fastest growing craft breweries in the country, widely known, as it happens, for its orange wheat beer. Ben Cook founded the brewery, and he owns it.
They're brewing orange wheat as we speak, yeah.
I think I'm opposed to orange wheat. I'm just saying.
But it's your flagship beer, right?
Flagship beer, yeah. It's 65 to 70% of all of our production.
No way.
Jeez. Yep.
Really?
Yep.
The oranges Ben uses are all local. Most of them come from within 5 miles of where we're standing.
They're almost like clementines.
Jim and I are in an orange grove on the south side of town.
Mm. That's pretty good, though.
Thousands of trees crammed into 23 acres right along a railroad. Owned by a guy named Bob Knight. Born here, went away to have a career, then came home to grow oranges, just like his great-granddad did.
It's a mixture of navel oranges and Valencia oranges.
Do you, by any chance, sell to Hangar 24 in that orange wheat beer that they make?
Yes, we do. And that gives me the biggest, most valuable bragging rights here in Redlands to be able to say I grow the oranges for Hangar 24.
Do you get beer in trade? If you give him oranges, he gives you beer or no?
You know, just for those bragging rights, don't tell him this, but I would give him the oranges.
And what's the scale of the oranges you sell them now? Yeah. Like how many?
When Ben first called up, he said, could we get as much as 6 boxes? I said, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so last week, they order weekly. Last week, they ordered 176. So they're one of our biggest customers.
Wow. Yeah. So I'm curious. One of my earliest jobs was picking oranges in a grove like this. And I know that it was really, really difficult work. Is the work itself, is it any different? The climbing up in the tree, is there any mechanization or advance or just the same basic work as it's always been?
Isn't that incredible? It's exactly the same.
Wow.
You're still, you know, hauling oranges up and down this ladder, you know, as much as 20 feet, carrying these bags that can carry 50, 60 pounds of oranges up and down.
What do you do when a tree gets really old? How do you know when it's done?
Well, we haven't run into that yet. The older the tree, the smaller the orange.
Yeah.
The older the tree, the sweeter the orange.
So what do you do with your small oranges?
We sell them to school districts.
Do you really?
Yeah, school districts want smaller oranges anyway.
Did you call up LAUSD and say, I got a bunch of small, sweet oranges,
yeah.
Basically?
Yeah.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oranges are the thing around here, right? I mean, they're on the city seal, I think, right? Orange blossoms and stuff?
Yeah,
Do you get a lot of support from the city? Is the city invested in you the way you're invested in the city?
The orange industry for the city of Redlands is actually, from an economic or financial point of view, minute.
Huh.
But from a heart share point of view, it's huge.
Heart share? That's a good phrase.
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. The people in the city of Redlands, you know, it's part of this culture we have. That is our, you know, that is our touchstone.
Oranges are right at the heart of what Redlands is using to get people to live here. They are the brand of the place. They're on street signs. They're on murals around downtown. Every so often, you see a little orange stand on street corners. And even though a lot of the groves are gone, there is still one packing plant right in the middle of town. Manuel Martinez runs it.
We'll start from the beginning, and then we follow the fruit.
This is just barrels and bins full of oranges.
Oh, yeah. Then that's only one small part.
Yeah, clearly. I'm wow.
Besides the oranges everywhere, obviously, there are pulleys and belts and vacuum packing machines. It's all kind of Rube Goldberg looking, truth be told. Oranges are sorted by cameras to decide whether they're better for juice or for grocery stores. We've got a pretty cool video, by the way, of that whole sequence from sorting to barcode sticker. It's at marketplace.org. But the point is that from here in a corner of Southern California, oranges go out to Hong Kong and Japan and grocery stores across this country. But still, it's not an easy industry.
So is the orange business getting better or getting worse?
It's getting tougher and tougher every year.
Why is that?
Well, because they've taken a lot of the trees out and built their warehouses. And that's the reason why now we're going all the way from Bakersfield to Arizona looking for navels and Valencias.
So the demand is still there, but the supply is harder to find?
That demand is there, but the supply, yes.
Oranges aren't the economic driver in Redlands, of course, but they are what helps make this slice of the American economy work. I did wind up trying that Hangar 24 orange beer, by the way.
It's, vaguely straw-colored, not much of a head. It smells like a beer.
You know what? Wasn't so bad. Our series with Jim and Deb Fallows and The Atlantic is called American Futures. We've got maps, a link to Jim's blog, and today that video from the packing plant and a quiz about the Redlands economy. Check it all out at marketplace.org. And while you're there, drop us a line. Tell us where you think we ought to go next.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on a Friday in which we ask you a question and you respond with a question. We're going to start a series after the New Year's called I've Always Wondered, those niggling little questions from business and the economy that have been on your mind forever. Like, how come a rotisserie chicken costs less than two frozen chicken breasts? Why do hotels give you sewing kits but no toothbrush? Why? People, why? Go to marketplace.org to check it out and to send us your questions. Help us out. All right, and on a Friday, that is Marketplace from 8 p.m. Today, the Dow up 42 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ added 46 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 up 8 points, about 0.5%. All of that in a busy, busy week, economy-wise. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Orr. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We will see you back on Monday. Take it easy. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.